Let there be light. These are the first words God speaks in the Bible. And in the creation story, the differentiation of light from darkness establishes the first condition for life to emerge. From that moment on in Scripture, light signifies the presence and effect of God. The prophet Isaiah proclaims the coming of the Messiah thus: "The people who lived in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shined." And the Gospels pick up this thread. In Luke, Jesus' birth is foreseen by Zechariah as the coming of the light. "The dawn from on high will break upon us to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death." And in John, it's written of Jesus, "In him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it." In a similar vein, a raft of biblical stories suggest that the presence of God irradiates, illuminates, and dazzles those who encounter it. The skin of Moses' face is said to shine as he descends from Mount Sinai. Saul is blinded by light, a light from heaven that flashed around him on his way to Damascus. And in a more contemporary encounter, Thomas Merton famously described what he sees in the light of God: people all around him shining like the sun, their inmost being blazing with the invisible light of heaven. And in all this, the metaphor and experience of light signifies truth, life, goodness, clarity, hope, and understanding. Enlightenment. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all, is how it's expressed in the first letter of John. And in this semantic field, darkness stands for evil, chaos, deception, ignorance, and death. Speaking of the refusal of Christ, John's Gospel writes, "The light has come into the world, and people love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil." Elsewhere, disciples are warned against participating in the works of darkness. And this imagery persists strongly in our cultural imagination. You think of Amnesty International campaigning to light a candle in the dark, of integrity commissions designed to shed light on corrupt and shady dealings. And the story of Jesus' transfiguration clearly draws on these meanings. In Matthew's version of this episode, Jesus' face, like Moses, is said to have shone like the sun. In the version that Frank just read us from Mark's Gospel, his garments become dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. We're to understand this event as a most profound encounter between Jesus and God, perhaps even a revelation of identification. "I am the light of the world," Jesus had said. And yet, what struck me in reading the story this week is that it also touches into a second, perhaps less well-known strand in the biblical imagination. On the Mount of Transfiguration, the disciples are first overwhelmed by light, but then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice. Just as Mary at the Annunciation is overshadowed by the power of the Most High. And here, shadow perhaps even darkness, are not opposed to God, but represent the place of God's intimate presence. A profound expositor of this strand of the biblical tradition was the 4th century theologian Gregory of Nyssa. Gregory drew on the life of Moses to develop an understanding of the journey to union with God in terms of a progressive entering into darkness. You'll recall that Moses' first encounter with God came in the form of the burning bush. Here God did appear as fire and light, and Moses is told to take off his shoes, for he's standing in holy ground. But then came a second appearing, or theophany, appearing of God to Moses, this time on the clouded mountaintop of Mount Sinai. And a third and culminating theophany, which entailed Moses drawing near, says the text, to the thick darkness where God was. Here are Gregory's words. What does it mean that Moses entered the darkness and then saw God in it? What is now recounted seems somehow to be contradictory to the first theophany, he says. For then the divine was beheld in light, but now God is seen in darkness. Well, Gregory goes on, let us not think there's a contradiction here. Our first encounter with God is about light, about throwing light on what in us needs to be illumined and faced up to. It involves a movement from, he says, the darkness of ignorance and sin to the light of truth. But the more we go on, he says, the more we approach to contemplation of God, the more we realise that God is beyond everything that is observed, beyond what our intelligence can think. And this means that to deepen our contemplation of God, we must leave behind previous ways of seeing and knowing. So our sight, our intelligence, appears to fail, to become clouded. But at this stage of the journey, the deepening gloom signals not evil or ignorance, but something more like unknowing and humility. As we continue in this way, says Gregory, there begins to dawn a different kind of knowledge of God, leaving behind everything that is observed, not only what sense comprehends, but also what intelligence thinks it sees. It gains access to the invisible and the incomprehensible, and there it sees God. This is the true knowledge of what is sought. This is the seeing that consists in not seeing, because that which is sought transcends all knowledge, being separated on all sides by incomprehensibility as by a kind of darkness. This is the darkness that Gregory describes as dazzling, a darkness not of death or emptiness, but one filled with luminosity. And I guess what strikes me in Gregory's account of spiritual growth is that ultimately the encounter with divine darkness and divine light operates in the same way. Because whether we're blinded by light or baffled by darkness, loss of sight is the condition for seeing God. Where seeing means not looking at an object, but being transformed by the one on whom we gaze. The poet Michael McCarthy writes of our looking hearts being changed until we can see blind. Well, these are memorable, beautiful images, the kind of paradoxes that early theologians seem to absolutely relish and revel in. But my guess is that most of us don't feel ourselves on the brink of penetrating these depths of mystical union, whether by means of overpowering light or dazzling darkness. Maybe it's just me. We may well feel ourselves overshadowed by the circumstances of our lives, or as if we're losing sight of anything we might once have named God. But is this really a sign of progress and deepening transformation? Or is it just debilitating fog and loss of faith? Not so much an exciting cloud seeded with hidden potential, but a grey and unremitting horizon of overwork, loneliness, mental muddle, and endless pandemic, in which we struggle to heal the wounds of our past, let alone find our way to a meaningful future. And if that's more like what the fog feels like, then how do we tell the difference? Well, let me offer this. The varied uses of metaphors of darkness, light, cloud, and overshadowing in Scripture suggest that our experience of these things must be discerned. Darkness has different qualities and leads to different places. On the one hand, there are the works of darkness: malice, deceit, envy, abuse, prejudice, fear, death. These, our tradition insists, are not of God. They are to be refused, their futility illumined and their power over us dispelled by the clear light of life and love. On the other hand, there is the thick darkness where God is said to be, the place where we learn to yield to God in absolute trust, letting go our drive to shape life on our own terms, beginning to see blind as we become slowly and sometimes painfully responsive to that deeper knowing, that deeper intuition that is beyond our cognitive, our rational reach. I said to my soul, "Be still and let the dark come upon you, which shall be the darkness of God," writes T.S. Eliot in East Coker. But what's so tricky in seeking to discern the difference between these forms of darkness, the darkness of the works of darkness and the darkness of God, what's so tricky in seeking to discern the difference and therefore the response appropriate to them is that there can be a profound overlap. Deceit and injustice do not belong to God. And yet experiences of injustice, trauma, illness, and malice are precisely what may precipitate us into the kind of dark night where we lose sight of our old version of God, our old version of ourselves, and a profound transformation can take place. When we read of Moses entering the cloud and of the cloud overshadowing the disciples at the transfiguration, it sounds kind of spiritually glamorous. But writing of John of the Cross's notion of the dark night of the soul, Rowan Williams insists that the alienation and dread intrinsic to this part of our journey to God are produced by all kinds of experiences, by the frustrations and humiliations of daily life that aren't glamorous at all, including the sordid illnesses, he says, of old age, mental disturbances, the loss of reputation and popularity, or simply finding oneself a nuisance to colleagues and family. And similarly, the Carmelite Ruth Burroughs warns against supposing that the darkness of God is a dramatic, interior, mystical thing. She writes, "What is the essence of your grief when all is said and done? Isn't it two things? A sense that you lack God, call it absence, call it abandonment, and at the same time a devastating awareness of your own wretchedness. Oh, I know, not in the least like what John of the Cross writes about. That is what you are hastening to tell me. Nothing grandiose like that, just drab, petty meanness and utter ungodliness." Yes, but that is what he's talking about. So I wonder what this suggests to you. What might it offer if we related to the dark, confused, and seemingly God-forsaken circumstances of our lives as the place of God's intimate presence? However little it feels like that, however unlikely it seems. T.S. Eliot approaches it this way: "I said to my soul, be still, and let the dark come upon you, which shall be the darkness of God. As in a theatre, the lights are extinguished for the scene to be changed, with a hollow rumble of wings, with a movement of darkness on darkness, and we know that the hills and the trees, the distant panorama and the bold, imposing facade are all being rolled away. The change of scene, the theatre. Or as when an underground train in the tube stops too long between stations and the conversation rises and slowly fades into silence, and you see behind every face the mental emptiness deepen, leaving only the growing terror of nothing to think about. Or when, under ether, the mind is conscious, but conscious of nothing. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope. For hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love and the hope are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not ready for thought. So the darkness shall be the light, and the stillness the dancing."